Good evening. Great to see everybody here tonight. It's good to be back home with you. As we continue our study of the time between of Judah alone through the years of silence, I'd like to begin by thanking Bryce and Stephen for filling in for me while I was away and really getting a good handle on these prophecies as we come back to a history lesson this evening. We're in lesson number 8, and if you're using a workbook, that's page number 29. We'll be talking about the fall of Judah. And probably if I ever taught this again, I might rearrange how I handle this material. But my thinking is that we get the history and we get our major points. Then we come back and cover some of the prophecies in between. And so now we're back to a history point. And we're very soon going to be moving back into some prophecies in between the two major history points. So as far as our memory work goes tonight, we are working on just getting some of those key markers in our mind, some of those chronological markers on the timeline. 605 BC with the first wave of exile, 597 BC with the second wave of exile, and then 586 with the destruction of Jerusalem and the third wave of exile, leading up to 539 with the destruction of the Babylonians and the rise of the Persian Empire. Years ago, and it's not just neat like I'm going to present it, but someone helped me to kind of think through how to put some faces, if you will, to the dates. And that is, if you think first wave of captivity, 605, who were the first ones to leave? Well, that would have been Daniel. And then you get to the second wave of captivity, and you put a face on that, and that's Ezekiel with the rest of the captives. And then you get to 586, and though he's been prophesying for a while, you get Jeremiah as kind of the face of what was happening in Jerusalem. And so if you want to kind of put those numbers with Daniel, Ezekiel, and Jeremiah, maybe that'll kind of help put some of the history and the prophecy together as we try to keep in mind what period we're talking about. That is the end of the period of Judah alone. All right, as you had a chance to read through 2 Kings 25 and probably a little bit easier because there's only one chapter instead of a whole prophecy, 66 chapters or even a longer section if you did the abbreviated reading. As you read 2 Kings 25, what were some of the things that just really jumped out at you as you see this as important or maybe that is applicable to you or to people today? What'd you notice?
My inclination was the fact that Zedekiah did not surrender to Nebuchadnezzar as he was told because of his pride, and it was the undoing of him and his family because of that very act.
Very good. And related to that, I've also had the thought of sometimes we have to do things that look unpatriotic in order to follow God. What else did you notice in this chapter?
I hadn't ever paid attention to it before, but when the Babylonians take Jerusalem in chapter 25, verse 8, you see them intentionally, deliberately going in to destroy the temple. So it's not something that just happens accidentally in the battle, catches fire or something. They intentionally wanted to destroy the house of their God.
Absolutely. Good point. And we'll probably come back to that point when we get to Ezekiel, that God has already left the house, leaving it as the prime target for these enemies to come in, which has some interesting parallels for when you get to Matthew 24, Mark 13, with God has already left the house, and now it's ripe for the Romans to come in. One more. Anybody have anything you notice? Joshua. Very good. Excellent. Yeah. God knows the end from the beginning, and he tells it, and he always tells it right. All right. As we get into our discussion questions here, let's talk a little bit about the background of what's going on. So we're going to kind of dip into chapter 24 just a little bit. What brought about the fall of Jerusalem and Judah, according to this text, and from whose presence were the people cast out? And this is for anybody.
Particularly from this text, it's the anger of the Lord. And I think from the standpoint of the importance of that, like obviously it's that it's from all the sins and everything that they've committed, but that gives context in chapter 25. It's all happened because of him, right? That he's doing it. And then of course it's from his presence that they're cast out.
Very good. And I think we do see some parallels with kind of the New Testament wrath of God, if you will. It's not that it's just the mean, wrathful God in the Old Testament, and then you get to the new, this new God of the New Testament that's just all grace and happiness. We find that God has the same wrath shown upon those who continue to reject him. And I think maybe a case in point would be Romans chapter 1. And isn't it that picture of God gives them up? And so he's going to push them away out of his presence if they continue to reject him, even though they really have no excuse. He's given them all the revelation they need, whether for the Gentiles in Romans 1 or especially for the people of God in the Old Testament and in the New. He's revealed everything. And yet if we continue to reject him, his wrath will arise. Now, what we learn from the Old and New Testaments is God is long-suffering. He waits as long as he can, but his wrath will eventually consume those who are against him. And let me just say one additional thing on that, that when we talk about hell with our neighbors or amongst ourselves, this is really a picture of the wrath of God fully poured out. It is that these who do not want to be in his presence, he will push them out of his presence, and it will be an eternal burning of the wrath of God upon them. All right, now the next section here is contrast 2 Kings 25 and 2 Chronicles 36 and what do the differing endings indicate about the timing and purpose of each record? And I asked Garrett to kind of talk us through this.
Yeah, so in 2 Kings 25, it ends with Jehoiachin being king and released by the king of Babylon. It seems to be written closer to or earlier than 2 Chronicles 36. And I think the message is to do as Jeremiah had told, submit to Babylon, and live out the captivity. Whereas 2 Chronicles 36 also records the fall of Jerusalem, but it has Cyrus permitting the return and going to build the temple. So the purpose there would be, okay, now it's time to move back and do God's work.
Excellent, very good. So you see a little bit of, with 2 Chronicles, maybe, let's do something. Whereas maybe 2 Kings is, we did something. And you're seeing the past versus the future. So, excellent. Appreciate that. Does anyone want to add anything to that? We'll talk some more about the glimmer of hope there at the end of 2 Kings in our connection question. But if nothing else, I think the picture there is, this is what led to exile. But then you see God's grace in their return, and let's get busy doing what God wants us to do, just as Garrett said. All right, so let's move into the second set of questions here with the siege. And we are so far removed from this that I thought it would be good for us to just kind of think through what a siege actually is, what the effects are. And so I asked Brother Paul McBroom to kind of lead us through what a siege is. Brother?
Built with a spring running through it also, so it would have a water supply. If not, they would have to bring in the water. make it to the city in time, be taken and have a hand, foot, an arm, or a leg cut off. These people would then be placed in the cages in pain and agony, crying out all day and all night, so that the people inside the city would become fearful. Water supply would be cut off, and as food and water ran out in the city, people would begin to starve. The enemy then would take rotting bodies of the dead, or animals that were killed, and as they were putrefied, throw it over the walls of the cities, destroying the inhabitants, who would then eat it and die from the diseases that were carried with the rotting food. And in turn, they would be eaten by other starving locals. This could last weeks or months, depending on the strength and size of the invading army, the city besieged, and the determination of the leaders of both sides not to give in.
That's a good description. But a bad one, isn't it? It's one of those things that when we can definitely see the importance of getting a little bit of historical context sometimes, because it's kind of like whenever we read about the crucifixion, it just says they crucified him. And they automatically knew exactly what that meant. And we have to go back and try to figure out what that meant. When it says he besieged the city, they automatically knew what that meant. It meant those things that Brother Paul was describing to us. This was a drawn out, it was a terrible way for people to die and ultimately surrender. And unless the invading army had to give up first. But we've seen some sieges up to this point. For instance, we had during the time of the divided kingdom with Elisha. You would have had the king go around and there's that story of we ate our child first and then she's not giving up her child. Or you see some of those same things happening in the siege of Jerusalem in AD 70, or up to AD 70, where cannibalism and all these terrible things are happening. And thus it makes a lot of sense when the Bible starts describing this siege warfare, especially of AD 70, of there's never been anything like what's going to happen here. It was terrible. And ultimately it was even worse because these are the people of God who are rejecting him and now losing all source of blessing. And the siege is a very symbolic measure of the attendant blessings of God being removed from them. Any thoughts on the siege warfare at this time and what was happening in 2 Kings 25? All right. What happened to the city and the army of Jerusalem, or the army of Jerusalem after the siege, according to verses 4 through 7? Hunt them down, destroy them. This is really kind of an iconic moment in the history of Israel, and then it's going to be repeated when we get to AD 70. So I'm hoping we're seeing some connections there. But destruction of the temple, siege of the city, destruction of all the mighty people, or carrying away of the mighty men. This is God's judgment upon his people. They continue to reject him. He will eventually reject them. And this is pictured here in the siege in 2 Kings 25. Anybody have any additional thoughts, comments on this? All right, so let's move into the destruction. Now the city has been sieged. Those who have escaped have been killed. And now we have the destruction outright in this third section here. No, go ahead.
First of all, just the patience that it would take for an army, that just seems so foreign to us that they would want to attack and just, you know, knock it down and go in. But this is just something that took, say, a couple of years, a year and a half. And then you are
There's no fight in them. Thinking about the patience of an invading army, whenever I was reading Josephus earlier this year and talking about not only the siege on Jerusalem, but also the siege of Masada, it's interesting to think of how long it took, because they just continued to build up rubble until they could go up to this plateau. And so it was just constant work on their part. But notice that it's much fewer soldiers killed on your side if you're able to siege the city and keep them inside. And so that the patience here of Babylon, the patience of Rome, and all those that use siege warfare, it was ultimately for the goal of you lose the fewest people and you wipe out the most. It looks terrible to us, and it is terrible. But I think the reason this is included here is to help us see this is what it looks like when a nation leaves God. And this is what it looks like when God leaves a nation. And again, Ezekiel is going to portray that, of the glory of God leaving Jerusalem, and now they have no protection. All right, any other thoughts on siege warfare here? All right, then let's go on to the destruction. This is a what and whom question, because there's multiple answers here. What whom did the Babylonians burn, destroy, steal, and kill after they entered Jerusalem? And we may have touched on this already, but let's hit some of the points that are made in verses 8 through 21. Actually, I gave that question to Gage. So, Gage, you're going to answer that for us. Do you notice as Gage was going through that list, the layering of just how much is being destroyed, is being desolated at this point? God could have just gave a line and said, they destroyed the city. But it goes through the house, the palace, the people, specific people, groups of people that are killed. Let me include the question I was just about to ask in this next one. Why would especially the burning and stealing have been a terrible blow to the people of Judah? Can you think of why the burning of the temple, the stealing of the utensils?
These were things that God had commissioned, that they had made for his service. And that if they had not seen the departure of God by now, then now this is kind of putting a final blow to the presence of God. More or less.
Very good. Bryce? I was about to bring that up if no one did. You know, you got that Jeremiah statement, don't you? The temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. These people were not basing their relationship with God on a real connection to God. They were basing it totally on, and there's a lot of parallels to the New Testament here, their lineage and their temple, their city. So it was all these physical markers that were saying, this is why we are the people of God, and this is why no one can do anything to us. One, they had a history of their rejection meant God's rejection of them, and that they weren't always protected. And so they had a false hope because they weren't basing their faith on God. They were basing it on things that were external to their relationship with God. Well, granted, was their lineage important? Was the temple important? But those things are only important so far as they have circumcised their hearts and they are in a right relationship with God. They have left behind their true connection to God. Therefore, he has no connection to them. And the people, the Babylonians, can come in and destroy them. Can you think of any other thoughts on this picture of destruction and what it would have meant for the people?
And you see, even Nehemiah hears about this later on, right? The walls are going down, the gates are burning with fire, and the lament of him after that. Right? So it does have an effect on them, but I think even from a practical standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Right. Steve?
I just think the enumeration here, of the detailed enumeration. Just from a standpoint, like if you're telling a story, it would be much easier, it seems, to summarize. They took everything associated with the temple, but it like goes through naming all the pieces and parts down to the really minute details, driving the point home to the readers. You know how thoroughly, you know, there's not a piece left. Mm-hmm. Nothing is left to you from this, and I think 1 and 2 Kings is that sort of warning, where 1 and 2 Chronicles is the hopeful kind of recounting. This is the more of the "I told you so" recounting of it, and I think this way of recounting this shows that.
Right, and this seems to be a granted, it is historical record, but this is the storytelling devices that God will sometimes use. You know, I think even in the New Testament, you see that in a judgment book like Revelation, you see a lot of these summaries of visions, and then all of a sudden you spend a whole chapter 18, describing it was this merchant and that merchant and this product and that product, and it just layers and layers and layers. Why? Because those were the things that were special to Rome. Trevor, I think your hand was up. Right. And we see that same kind of language when we get to the second destruction of the second temple in Matthew 24. He says, not one stone is going to be left upon another. And they say, when is this going to happen? This must be the end of the world, the end of the age. And so it seems that Jews do connect that idea of the end of the temple means the end of the world for us. Of course, I think Jesus corrects that in Matthew 24, just as they were going to see through the correction of the chronicler that their end has not come fully because a remnant will survive. And the same is true with Matthew 24, that a remnant does survive, but it's not ethnic Israel anymore that is that remnant. Any additional thoughts on that?
Yeah, I just have one more. The idea of destroying, you know, the temple and, you know, destroying their acts of worship was, you know, not exclusive to the Babylonians versus the Babylonians, I think, had already been doing that. The Assyrians before them is a way to really destroy the identity of the people they conquered. And I think it speaks to the working of God that, you know, in the case of the Jews, that wasn't there. God still had a plan for them and brought them down.
Very good, yeah. The excellent point, and you can kind of jog the thought that really you see that happening incrementally through the waves of exile. That you take away your royals that are your smartest, your finest, and you give them new, we're going to study this with Daniel, you give them new names, you teach them new language, you teach them new literature. You're trying to take away their identity. Then, if that doesn't work, what's he do? He takes away captives and gets them out of their homeland into a foreign country, tries to strip them of their identity. When that doesn't work, you destroy the center of their identity. So, excellent point. And even though that may have been Nebuchadnezzar's thought process, ultimately God is the one who is behind this. And as you said, you also see his providence, that he is protecting his people, their identity, and his plan as you move forward. Any additional? Yes.
One more thing about them coming in. And, I mean, if they want to overcome the nation, they could kill the people take the people captive if they want. They could steal all the good stuff and leave. But no, they knocked it down and they burned it, set fire to it. I don't know. It's just the God is behind all this, but he also used very cruel people to accomplish his ends. And it may be partly what you said, what God thought about the temple. Not that he didn't like the temple, but you know, what he thought about it in comparison to he said, I'm sick of your sacrifices. He wanted sacrifices. He wanted the sweet-smelling aroma, but it's a sweet-smelling aroma because of the people and how they are treating them and worshiping them and acting toward it and toward each other. But it stinks if they're not acting properly.
Right. I can't remember where it is in Proverbs, but it says something along the lines of, the prayer of the wicked is an abomination to the Lord, but the sacrifices of the righteous are sweet-smelling, or something along those lines. And so you're seeing the connection there that, and I think sacrifices and prayers were put together, but the wicked, if they are not right in their heart, it's an abomination to him. But whenever they have the right heart, then those sacrifices actually mean something. And I think we'll come back to this theme when we get to Ezekiel, where he will prophesy about this whole concept of the defilement of the temple. And he used some fairly drastic terms to describe how they had defiled the sanctuary and why God is going to destroy it. Any additional thoughts? Yes, Jim.
Just the big blow to these guys, every prophet they had was telling them, no, you're safe. These guys will leave, except for one. One man told them, no, this is God's ship. Leading to what was said in Leviticus. And they saw it all come pass.
Right. Excellent point. Any other thoughts? All right, then I don't think we'll do the comparison here for time's sake, but hopefully you had a chance to look at Leviticus 26. There are a lot of similarities to the curses that God had placed upon them in the law of Moses and what actually happens. All right, so let's talk a little bit about the end of the history here with the coup. Whom did Nebuchadnezzar appoint as governor over the land of Judah, and what was his fate? First of all, who was it?
Gedaliah.
Okay. And what happens to Gedaliah? Yep. He's assassinated. And it's interesting, again, if we take a look at names here, Gedaliah, you have the adjective Gedol, means great, good. And then you have Yah at the end is Yahweh. So his name means Yahweh is great, and God demonstrates, has demonstrated it, and is demonstrating it, in that this one does not remain in the position of leadership. God has proven himself great in his judgment, and even in this man's assassination, it shows that when you reject God, doesn't matter what man appoints you, God can bring you down. And we'll see that in Daniel. Any additional thoughts there on the end of the Jews or the Jewish people here in 586 and surrounding? All right, then let's talk a little bit about the connection. And then we'll get into application here in a moment. First of all, I did want to give a little bit of extra time because I realize I haven't been doing so. So before we do the question that I have in here, I made it a point in the upcoming lessons to try to actually give some time if you found some other connections. And so I think we may just have a little bit of time to do that. Did anybody find any other connections not related to 2 Kings 25, 27 through 30 with Jehoiachin? If not, that's okay. I'm just giving an opportunity. All right. Then let's talk about this question here. What glimmer of hope does 2 Kings 25, 27 through 30 present? And in what way or ways does it point to Jesus? Kevin?
It shows we have visibility of Zedekiah's lineage, which was they killed his sons, and they killed him. They didn't kill him, they took him away. All we know is he evaporated into nothingness after that. He went out after that. But Jeconiah, we do see that he was not extinguished. And in 1 Chronicles 3:17, we find out he did have sons. You know, Jeremiah says he is childless. If you say childless to a nation that for centuries the child of a king is a king, that makes sense that he's, it means that him being childless means he doesn't have a son that is a king, an earthly king. But as far as it pointing to Jesus, I didn't see it in this passage specifically, but it does keep alive.
Excellent. That reminds me of, let me find it here. Yeah, 2 Kings 8:19, where you're in the time of Jehoram. But in 2 Kings 8:19, I'll start in verse 18. And he walked in the way of the kings of Israel, just as the house of Ahab had done, for the daughter of Ahab became his wife, and he did what was evil in the sight of Yahweh. However, Yahweh was not willing to make Judah a ruin for the sake of David his servant, since he had promised him to give a lamp to him through his sons always. What kind of picture do we have here with David having a lamp, that is, which is then connected to sons? What do you think is being described here? There's a light in the darkness, that there is still hope. And you have this lamp terminology that's used throughout, from the time of David onward, which seems to be this picture of there's going to be a source of light, of hope, of something yet to come. And notice that it is connected here to give him a lamp through his sons always. So this was not just unique to David, but this is continuing to his sons. There's always going to be some light. And isn't it interesting that it ultimately comes to the ultimate son of David, Jesus, who describes himself as light. And thus, he is the light who sits on the throne of David. And I think we see that even as Kevin pointed out in these little pictures of you think all hope is lost with Kaniah. Write him down as childless, and yet he has sons, and this promise continues. This goes all the way back to that key passage we need to memorize the chapter at least, 2 Samuel 7, is that God has made a promise to David, and he's going to keep it. In fact, Kevin alluded to Matthew chapter 1 with the genealogy. Isn't it interesting that the key figures that are mentioned, that Jesus is the son of Abraham, the son of David, these are the two major covenants that are made that are coming through the Messiah of the promise to Abraham and the promise to David. Kevin, then Stephen.
And we do our children a disservice when we don't explain while on earth there would be a genealogy in Matthew 1 and Luke 3. I was well
If the chronicler decided that you should spend about 9 chapters thinking about names, it may be somewhat significant.
As you're closing out a book, a record, this is, if you just think, just step back a minute, this is such an insignificant detail. on the grand landscape, except theologically, right? Mm-hmm. Other than that, there's no significance to the fact that Jehoiachin is coming out of prison. What does it matter for Israel going forward? He's not going to be put back on the throne. And, you know, there's nothing to make of this except a glimmer of hope. Mm-hmm. And so, like, from a historian's perspective, this is a useless detail. But from God's perspective, it's obviously the point, right? Mm-hmm. That hope is not lost. And so this is this is not the way to end a record of Israel's downfall. Everything's gone, everything's spoken. But hey, Jehoiachin got to eat at the king's table. You don't end a story like that unless you're making a point with that.
Yeah, if it was just men writing this, it would be, they're still in Babylon. What does that help us? we don't have a king here in the land. And so that is important. And let me just make it as an aside, point out that it's those insignificant details written at that time that show that there is a God who's behind this book. This is not just man throwing in insignificant details and somehow it comes together and makes an interesting story. God has always been looking forward to Jesus. And thus the title of our study this quarter is The King is Coming. This little glimmer of hope is saying the King is still coming. All right, we're almost out of time, so let me state in application here that what we see in this section is that God is long-suffering, but he does not stay judgment forever. Exile was the punishment of rebellious Israel and Judah. Hell will be the punishment of sinners. If we read 2 Peter 3, 8 through 15, we learn that this world is reserved for fire. Judgment is coming. We're looking for a new heavens and a new earth. And if that's the case, we need to be holy in our conduct. We need to be looking forward to Jesus coming. And if we continually pursue God, we will not be like faithless Judah that was sent into exile. But we are in our exile now, and we will return to our homeland someday. Appreciate everyone's participation. We'll go ahead and close out there. And if everyone would go ahead and read and prepare for lesson 9, I will have new workbooks available on Sunday.